Well, welcome. Let's see. Are we supposed to start at 2:30? Because I'd be happy to take questions until then. Oh, Lord, have mercy. Well, forgive me then. Okay. We're going to talk today about different areas of church liability, how to prevent them, and some different remedies. We're also going to talk about a new tax law that impacts ministers that probably most of you haven't heard about. And I want to say, first of all, that this term right here, negligent supervision, if you want to end and prevent 90% of all the liability that churches ever face, that's it right there. It comes under the heading of negligent supervision. You can just about, if you cover this area, you can just about forget about your church ever having, facing any type of liability. What is negligent supervision? The worst form of it is a problem in your nursery, your church nursery. If you have a molestation incident there, it is without question about the worst nightmare a church can face. That's the worst one. Other examples are field trips. I wouldn't recommend you go to the rifle range with the teenagers. And any other activity in which there typically are kids or teenagers, even adults, in some sort of setting that there could be some type of injury or accident, so on. The easiest way to prevent negligent supervision is to screen everybody that comes to work for your church. Now, when I say work for your church, that means volunteers as well as staff members, employees. As we talked about in the first session, volunteers legally are the same as staff in terms of liability. A volunteer working for your church can bind your church for liability purposes exactly the same as a paid staff member. And how this works is, let's say you've got a field trip and you go to the archery range and there's a problem because the two volunteers are supposed to be running the program or stand over here talking and not paying attention. But it wasn't their fault the accident happened. It was one of the kids' faults. But the way the law works is it's not the kids' fault, it's the volunteers' fault because they weren't supervising adequately. And guess whose fault it is if it's a volunteer? The church. Because the church is the person that hired the volunteer, quote, or allowed the volunteer to work at the church. That's just how it works. It works that way for every other type of liability that falls into this heading. So let's say that you're accepting volunteers for the church nursery, you're hiring people for the church nursery. How do you prevent some terrible accident from happening or incident? You screen everybody. Criminal records check, full employment application, even for volunteers. Ask questions, check references, check past churches that have been attended, etc., etc. What's the easy way to prevent nursery problems? Don't let anybody work or volunteer in your nursery unless they've been a member of your church for at least a year. That will end 90-some percent of all problems with people in nursery because psychologically, most people that are child molesters want instant access to kids. They're not going to wait around a year, and there's a great value in having somebody in your church you've known for a year. You sort of know that person, and you know what they're good at, what they're bad at. Same rule for bus drivers. You certainly want to check to see what the driving history has been. You know, if they're having a traffic accident every other month, you don't want to hire them to drive your church bus. If they've been convicted of embezzling from Donald Trump, you don't want to hire them to do your church books. Or maybe you do. I don't know. Now, one other tremendous way that costs you nothing to prevent problems, not only the nursery, but other places, the two-adult rule. Always have two adults present at all times whenever there's a child in your church, period. Because the kids, you're responsible for those kids. You're responsible to their parents. I know all of you want to give them a safe environment. If there's always two adults present, two things happen. It makes both adults more careful in how they carry out their duties, and it prevents false accusations. Because some kids today are so sensitized to any kind of, you know, if somebody looks at them the wrong way, they think they're being abused. So, and it's not the kid's fault. They may sincerely believe that. You know, a lot of people that want to work with kids know that kids need to be hugged and loved, but not against their will, number one. And also, some kids misinterpret an innocent hug. If you've got two adults there, then there's an accusation. You've got a witness. Does that make sense? That's really... I'm sorry, yes, sir.
Is it true that those two adults should not be husband and wife as well? They shouldn't be...
I think that's a good rule. The question, should it be husband and wife, two adults? I think that's a good rule not to have husband and wife. Some churches, smaller churches, maybe aren't going to be able to get enough volunteers to get around that situation. But I think that would be, if you can work that out, definitely is a good idea. Yes, sir. Oh, heavens. Good question. What legally, what's considered an adult? In your state, you know, it could be 18, 19, 20, 21, in terms of who you're going to have with the kids. I think you got to use your good judgment as pastor, because there's going to be, you know, some 20-year-olds are very responsible and some aren't. And, you know, I think the best rule is, as a parent, who would you want taking care of your kids? And if the people you select would be suitable for you, in your opinion, to take care of your kids, then they ought to be suitable to take care of other people's kids. That's just common sense. And, you know, if you think of it in terms of how would I screen people that I wanted to leave my kids with, if you do the same thing for people that you're going to leave your parishioners' kids with, then you shouldn't have a problem. I mean, these simple rules and careful background checking should eliminate 98-99% of all potential problems in nursery. There's probably no perfect system, but this is about as close as you get. And there's unfortunately a lot of other detail I don't have time to get into, but I want to we'll take questions on this. Now, let me talk about just quickly some of the areas of liability that board members and pastors face that are not as, maybe not as common, not as severe, but can come up. The big one is debts to the church. If you sign your name as pastor on a loan or anything that the church is obligated, unless you sign it like this, then you could be personally liable. And how this is, the name of the church by Sam Smith, pastor, or however you sign your name. If you do that, it's clear. You could even add name of church, comma, Kentucky Nonprofit Corporation, or whatever. You're clearly making a statement that you're signing in your capacity as an officer or director of the church, not in your personal capacity. And we had a gentleman came up in the first session who had just signed a multi-million dollar refinancing in his personal name. Sorry, I shouldn't laugh. But I just thought, you know, the banker should have said something to the man. That was just, I told him to go back to the bank and explain that there had been an error. Because, you know, unwittingly, and I'm sure, I hope the bank didn't do this on purpose, but, you know, he's on the note personally. A lot of churches have there is a widespread practice of having board of deacons, board of directors, sometimes parishioners in the church, sign on loans for the church building. I just highly recommend that you don't do that. And if the bank won't work with you, find another bank. Because give you a classic example of a church that I know about that did a large bond issue. And then the pastor had a problem and left. And, of course, the attendance went down. And with the attendance, the offerings went down. And then the bonds went down. And then the parishioners who had signed on the bonds, houses went down. It was a total disaster, like just unthinkable. And could have been prevented by just following the rule, you just don't sign anything in your personal name. Because the reason you have a, and by the way, if I hope everyone's church here is incorporated, if it's not, it should be. And the reason is because in every state, corporations, even if they don't cut off liability perfectly, they do cut off liability more than just having an unincorporated church. There have been some people that have stated, that, oh, well, you're coming under state control if you incorporate. My friends, if you are on the soil of the United States, you're already under state control, and it doesn't change more or less if your church is incorporated. It just insulates you from liability. It's very, I'm sure everybody's incorporated, but in case you're not, you should be. Racial discrimination. Any form of racial discrimination at a church will cost you your tax exemption. Sexual harassment. I doubt that that's a problem in most churches. Misuse of church funds. What is misuse of church funds? Obviously, embezzlement would be misuse. But believe it or not, if you spend a lot of money, the board of directors votes, and spends a lot of money on some project that doesn't work out, you can be sued personally for that, unless you've got very good indemnification provisions in your bylaws and so forth. For example, let's say that, and you see this occasionally where church needs a new building, they go purchase the building, and maybe all the documents aren't carefully reviewed. And I can just give you an example. It was a church in, I believe it was Wisconsin or Minnesota somewhere, and they were buying a church building from another church, and they called me, and I know the pastor thought I was crazy. I said, well, I faxed him, here's some things you ought to just check out, wiring, plumbing, you know, ha, 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 toxic waste, ha, ha, ha. And guess what was on the church property in the front lawn of the church was an 800-gallon canister of toxic waste buried under the, unbelievable. And had they not found that before they purchased the building, the cost to remove it, I don't remember how much it was a lot of money to get the thing out and haul it away. You know, the parishioners could have sued the board and said, you know, you're taking our money and, you know, flush it down the drain because you didn't carefully steward this transaction. Fortunately, those types of cases are rare. But point being, whenever you do any type of financial transaction that has lots of zeros attached to it, carefully document what you've done. Write it down. Have all the documents in a file that show, you know, at the time it seemed like a good idea. Why did it seem like a good idea at the time? What was it that made you think that this was a prudent move? So that later, if it turns out that something went wrong, you've got proof that you acted reasonably under the circumstances. That's what cuts off liability, is that you acted reasonably. Nobody can foresee the future. But the board, at a minimum, has to carefully evaluate when it spends large amounts of money. Negligent hiring and of employees, selection of volunteers, we talked about that. That's the big area of liability for churches today. There's nothing worse than that one for dollar amounts of judgments in court. Then there's various types of less important areas. Now, what should directors do in a board meeting? They should pay attention. They should vote only for items that they agree to, not just to be nice and get along. If they don't agree with an item, they should vote against it and make sure that it's noted in the minutes that they voted against it. Very important. Why? Because later on, if it turns out there's a liability situation, and say there's 12 directors, 11 vote for, 1 against, guess who will not be liable? The guy that voted against it. Had a pastor in the first session asked me, well, if that's the case, then no one would ever vote for anything. And he's right. And that's why we have these workshops only for pastors and not board members. Okay. It's a good idea not to have personal interests in financial transactions of the church. Not forbidden. And some cases, maybe, and you have a contractor in your church, supplier, vendor, something, you might want to have that that sort of relationship. If you do, be sure you carefully follow the intermediate sanctions rules we'll talk about very shortly here. Now, every director has a duty by law to scrutinize and discuss each item the board votes on. And a lot of board members don't take that duty very seriously. Directors are accountable legally to, believe it or not, church employees, creditors, and the IRS. One other area of liability I want to mention is payroll tax. For God's sake, pay your payroll tax for church employees. What should you do if you can't pay your payroll tax? Lay off the employee. Sounds, you know, maybe draconian, but it's better than not paying it, because the hottest hot button the IRS has is payroll taxes. That's the foundation of the voluntary tax system in America, and they will flat come out and padlock your church. That's not a joke. I've seen it happen. If you don't pay your payroll tax, if your CPA is telling you, oh, everybody's an independent contractor, you don't have to withhold, get rid of your CPA and get someone who knows what they're talking about. I've seen this constantly. Yes, sir.
What's the, like, ministers considered self-employed, church
that pay payroll tax on them? Make a differentiation. That's a good question. Are ministers considered self-employed? Almost in every case, no, they're considered employees. However, ministers, even if they are employees, are exempt from withholding. They are exempt from withholding. So you could get away with that, but all that happens is every April 15th, you as a minister have want to go away to another country till that month goes past because you owe so much money. Can the church pay your income tax for you? Yes, as a taxable fringe benefit. I'll repeat that. The church can pay all your taxes, income and Social Security tax, and just put it on your W-2. And I think they should. There you go. Well, let me tell you, because I every time I say this in public, I always get, it's either a CPA or somebody would question it. So one time when I was in Washington, the IRS National Office, wandering around their big building there, I wandered into four separate tax officials' offices, and I said, let me ask you something. Can a church pay the income and Social Security tax for the pastor as a taxable fringe benefit? And you know what all four IRS National Office officials told me? Yes. You know what two of them told me? And we prefer it that way. Well, that's interesting. And could you help me, let me know your thinking? Because ministers are exempt from withholding, and they end up owing all this money on April 15th, we'd much rather the church pay the tax for them, because then we get the money. The IRS would rather you go back and tell your board that. The IRS wants the church to pay all your taxes for you. Not joking, that's the truth. I guess there's people in here that haven't got my book yet, because I put this out every year. And I'm just going to tell you, if you can imagine, if the church is not doing it for you now, April 15th rolls around, you file your tax return, you don't owe any money, you get a refund, put it towards your boat, you know? Okay, I am serious. You mean you don't have a boat? Yes, sir.
What you say about the independent contractors, in other words, if you pay the difference, somebody asked a question about the difference between them. Independent contractor. Suppose if I have a person who wants a contractor, a member of the congregation, they want a contract for my nursery, take care of my nursery.
I mean, you can, but here's what's going to happen. If they don't file their tax return and they get audited, you will get audited. And they will make you pay their tax.
But if I got a signed contract by them stating in that contract they have to pay their taxes.
You know, here's what I recommend. I'm not going to tell you. That area of the law is so... in a given situation, maybe you could. I'm not going to tell you it's illegal, but I don't recommend it. I would have everybody that works at your church on a W-2 from the pastor on down, period. And the reason why is because you're never going to have an issue that way. I'm not saying you can't do it another way, but for sure you won't have an issue. Now, if there's any pastors not on a W-2, here's why you should be. It lowers your risk of audit by 500%. Do we need any other reasons? I don't think so. Also, gives you eligibility for fringe benefits such as health insurance you don't have on a 1099. Yes, sir. Yeah, you know, a lot of churches pay their musicians or choir members by the week and so forth and so on.
If,
like a scholarship. You know, here's what my advice would be. First of all, I would put them on W-2, but if you want to keep them on a contract basis, what you should do is pay them by the service. In other words, if you're going to have nursery workers or choir members, you don't pay them so much a year. It's a flat fee per service. And then I'd go and say something like, and you agree to show up at least 30 services a year or something. Now, that probably, and don't quote me because, you know, it may or may not work. Would that pass IRS muster? Possibly. Couldn't guarantee it, but that would give you the best shot at it. But it's just, you know, ADP is a great payroll service. They don't pay me, but I think they're great. They're cheap, and they do all the withholding, and then you don't have to worry about it. If the people are going to pay their tax anyway, you might as well do the withholding. Churches can be exempt from matching FICA, unlike many other organizations. So why don't we, since we're on the subject of taxes, why don't we talk about intermediate sanctions? And let me, first of all, write this up here, what this is. This is a new law which applies to ministers and actually all nonprofits. Intermediate sanctions. How many folks in here have ever heard that word term? I knew it. I was talking to the IRS National Office on this Monday, which I have some good news for you, by the way, from there. And I told them that I thought that, in my experience, nearly no ministers in America even know this law exists. You know when this law was passed? 1996. And how many churches do I know that have gotten a notice from the IRS telling them that they have any obligations? None. So, I'm going to tell you about it. And let me tell you the bad news first, and I'll tell you the good news. The bad news is that this law states that if you... Actually, just if an IRS agent thinks you make too much money, they can hit you with a 25% penalty, number one, and then they can make you pay all the money back that they thought you were making too much. Then, they thought. That's the bad news. But there is better news in a minute. Any of your board members that voted on your package can be hit with a 10% penalty. There's a limit on that one of up to $10,000 per incident. And if you don't pay the money back, let's say you're making $40,000 a year and they think you should just make $30,000, they can go back 3 years, make you pay $10,000 a year back to the church for 3 years plus the 25% penalty. If you don't do that, then the penalty goes up to 200%, which is kind of the cozy IRS way of saying we mean it. Yes. Now, I'm sure...
I'm filing a form. I've got a W-2, mm-hmm. and they think that I am making too much with that W-2.
Right.
They can come back and tax me for what they think...
Well, they have to audit you first, but yeah, they can. Every seminar that I've ever presented this in, there are people in here thinking he's making this up just to sell his book. I'm sure you are. But I'm not making it up. I promise you I'm not. Now, here's the good news. That's the bad news. The good news is that there is a safe harbor under this law. And if you get the safe harbor, they can't challenge you at all, no matter what they think. The safe harbor has three components. By the way, just to let you know, I think this is a horribly unfair law that should never apply to churches. It was originally applied to doctors and hospitals, and some overzealous bureaucrat in Washington expanded it to cover all nonprofits and forgot to put the words that are in every other tax statute in the last 40 years, except churches. So I've been working on trying to get the law repealed. In fact, here's me and my wife having dinner with Trent Lott.
Do you really think that was an accident? I'm just curious.
An accident?
I don't think it was an oversight.
No, well, it may not have been, but I hope it was. I hope to God that nobody would think that. I mean, 95% of churches in America, there's no way the pastor makes too much money. Amen? I mean, okay.
This is strictly for nonprofits.
This is strictly for nonprofits. I mean, it's ridiculous. The idea of the law in the first place, the good question, was is there's relationships with doctors and hospitals. A lot of hospitals are nonprofit. And doctors were getting these relationships where they would get a piece of this nonprofit action over here and were making hundreds of thousands of dollars. So somebody said, hey, wait a minute. You can do that at a for-profit hospital, but, you know, the reason you have this nonprofit status is because hopefully you're charging less to your patients. That's how the whole thing started. And what the IRS lobbied for, they wanted a rule that would let them penalize a doctor without taking away the tax-exempt status of the hospital. They wanted to destroy the hospital. They just wanted to be able to selectively take care of doctors they thought were running afoul. That's why the penalty is on the individual instead of the organization.
Yeah. Well, I mean, since you need the televangelists fall under this?
Everybody, all the televangelists.
What I mean is, did they use that against them?
Well, what they should have done, they should have carved out, in my opinion, if they were going to do anything with any kind of religious organization, they should have carved out sort of an area of, say, you know, over 200,000 or 300,000 a year, something like that. But they didn't. So what I've been trying to do is, number one, I've tried to, I'd like to see the people that passed the law to unpass it, regards to churches. And in the meantime, I've been filing comments with the IRS in Washington, trying to get them to ameliorate the effects of it. And I have some good news. My latest set of comments has, looks like it's been accepted. And here, first let me tell you the safe harbor. Let me tell you what I think the newest rules are going to be based on my conversation on money. Number one, the three elements you got to have a safe harbor, the independent board or comp committee. That just means that there's more people on the board that are not your family than are your family, in essence. If you're, and most churches are set up that way. Churches that are family run need to have a separate compensation committee that just sets compensation. In other words, they want somebody to say, now you don't, this is not a law, you have to do it this way. It's just if you want a safe harbor, you have to do it this way. As long as the compensation committee or your board, if it's independent, somebody outside your immediate family is setting your compensation. You also cannot have somebody on the board that you pay, that's your employee, because obviously you can influence them. Okay, that's number one. Number two is comparability data. We'll come back to that one because that's really the key issue. And three, detailed minutes. You have to have minutes that just explain how the board or comp committee looked at this data and came up with your salary. Because it could be more or less than what the comparability data suggests. Now, the problem with the law when it was passed is it talks about getting a custom survey from a compensation firm. This is ridiculous. I mean, those things are $5,000 and up. And yeah, the comparability data, the you know, some kind of salary comparison. I mean, the law says you got to have a custom survey from a compensation firm. That's crazy. I mean, churches just don't have $5,000 sitting around to go hire some consultant to come in and tell you how much the pastor should make. Yeah. Right. Well, that's exactly right. My comment to the IRS was, since 95% of all churches don't have a problem anyway, this is a stupid law that applies to them, why don't you allow two types of comparability data that are not currently... One, there's now an exception, $1 million and under. If a church has $1 million of income or less, you can use, or will be able to use, once they adopt this, and I believe they have adopted it as of Monday, any generic salary survey that has at least 100 churches as part of the statistical base. Now, some of these are more useful than others because some of the ranges are like, you know, churches from 300 to 600. There's a lot of room in there. But, you know, people are going to come up with, based on the structure that I'll be soon writing, and make it very simple, believe me, where you can pinpoint almost any church, pastor, geographical area, size of church, income, whatever, and come up with, here's a target number. Now, you don't have to be at that target. You can be above it or below it. But at least you've got something for the board to talk about and say, yeah, that's what most pastors in this situation make, but our guy is so talented and brilliant and et cetera that we're going to pay him double that. Okay. But you can do that. But you got to have a starting place, and that's what these detailed minutes are, explaining why you're paying more than the norm. The second thing that they've tentatively agreed to is they're going to let denominational churches use internally generated grids. And that's so wonderful because most denominations have this information. If they don't give you the information, they could give it to you. And once they do, then bingo. And there's a third rule there are about, I don't know if they're going to adopt this one, but at least, here's what they told me. They told me that they informally agree with this, whether they put it in the new regs or not. If you make less than $80,000, you're just not on the radar screen. They just they're not even going to look at you. Well, don't say amen to that. You're supposed to have be praying to be on the radar screen, right? But that's the good news. It looks like that they are graciously moving to accommodate churches in America, and I appreciate that. And I hope to someday report to you that some of the intelligent people we've elected to the United States Congress have realized that they made an error when they forgot to say accept churches. So you can be praying about that. Okay.
That was a law passed in 1996.
1996. It went into effect on September 14, 1995, the year previous to that, retroactive. And covers every, that's a good question, covers every comp package from then on. Now, if you have the safe harbor, those three details, they cannot touch you. You are immune. If you don't have it, then, you know, and I hope that most agents would not be so ignorant as to challenge your compensation, but under the law, they could.
I need you to go back to think, I don't know the rest of it, to explain what you said. If he, an agent sitting in his office, think that I am making too much.
Well, he has to audit you first.
He has to audit me first.
But if he audits you and he thinks, gosh, you're making too much money for a minister, then it's his opinion at that point, unless you have the safe harbor. Now, if you have the safe harbor, it doesn't matter what he thinks. He can go pound sand. Because that's it. That's, if you got that, you can't be challenged.
Let me tell you the reason why I'm saying that. I was audited once when I was bivocational. I was working at Whirlpool, and then I was also at the church.
Right.
And I had convention expenses when I had receipts, and I was audited. I took those in,
the IRS agent refused to accept my receipts that I had, and they were coming from the hotel, stationary, all on there. He refused to accept that, and I had to pay taxes. And one of the other agents said to him, "So that's not right. He has his receipts. Why are you doing that?" "Because he makes too much money as a pastor."
Right. And there's a lot, unfortunately, there is that strain of people out there that thinks like that.
Yeah, but I pay taxes at Whirlpool, and I'm paying taxes on the money at the church. So how can I be him to say that?
No, you're right. It was not his prerogative to say that. But rest assured that all his people will be burning in hell someday. Number one.
Amen.
Amen. Number two, what they should have told you is you could have gone to appeal. Had you gone to appeal, the appeals officer would have knocked that out that quick. That was completely, they were off the wall to do that. That was completely unfair to you. And I'm sorry that it happened. Yeah. They can do that under this law. That's a great question. Under this law, if you can find, now you have to probably get a custom study, if you can show that, but due to your efforts, either the church's assets grew, revenues grew, or parishioners grew, they can pay you a bonus based on your performance. Absolutely, yes, sir.
What about you go to the church for 20 years and they say, "Pastor, we want to send you to the Holy Land, or we want to send you on a cruise or something
great.
Like that"? Does that come down as added income? I mean,
well, here's how you do that. The church can always pay for your vacation and should. Is it taxable? It depends. If there are palm trees where you go, it's probably taxable. If there are palm trees and communists where you go, it's probably not taxable. And whatever. Yeah, pretty much. It really is. I mean, if it's a vacation destination. But they should pay it anyway and just put it on your W-2, even if it is taxable. And if you can set up, I'm going to take some more questions. I just want to say one quick thing while everybody's still here. But yeah, they should pay for your vacation. And do your best to make it non-taxable if you can. This is a, I'm going to, really, you know, you think I'm joking when I say it, but I'm really going to make you a free offer. I'm not kidding. This is my tax book, which has come out for a number of years, and will come out again this year, probably this month. This is, has anybody ever heard of Parsons Technology? Okay, well, they're a great company. They had a program a few years ago called Personal Tax Edge, which was bought out by Intuit. And I used to publish my tax software, Clergy Tax. Of course, when Intuit bought it, I, my little minnow software took off with the shark. Well, now, a bunch of the people that wrote Parsons Personal Tax Edge have formed a new company called Second Story Software, and they have a program called Tax Act. This is the second year it's been out. And it is, looks great, works great, it's wonderful. And what else they have done, because they care about pastors, they have built a worksheet into the program which mirrors the worksheet in Clergy Tax. And the beauty of Clergy Tax is, you know, if you have to do a tax return, make it easy as you can. There's only 12 boxes. You got to find the numbers in 12 boxes. You plug them in. It does most ministers' tax return right there. Now, these 12 boxes are now in the software, which will be out this month. And what I want to do is make an offer that with two tiny strings attached. I'm going to give you this for free, for real, as a beta test site. Now, it's not beta software. It's production will be sold in retail. But it's the first time the book and the software have actually ever really been integrated, and I just want to know what you think. So here's the two small strings. I will give you the software and the book, and you can do your taxes with it. I'll also give you the state software. And all you have to do is write back, and I'll give you the evaluation form, and tell me what you honestly think, good or bad, what you like, what you didn't like, what you do different, so I can improve it for next year. And if you happen to say something really nice, then I'd like to be able to use your comments in our advertising. We have endorsements on the back of the book and so forth. So those are the two small strings. And if you're interested, as we, I'm going to take more questions, but just write your name and address on a piece of paper, write beta, and I'll be happy to send you this program. Excuse me? Oh, yeah, business card's fine. Yeah, anything, just, you know. And I'll be glad to send it to you. There is no cost at all. I even paid the postage, everything. And one last thing. We talked some about the nursery situation. I did a video for Regal Books. It also has in here probably the world's first reproducible forms. Got all the screening forms, policies, everything. And the reproducible means you just make copies of them. Because I've always hated that, you know, little notice you get on about everything you buy. You know, the FBI is going to come and haul you off if you make a copy of this. So these are for churches, and it costs about, 20 minutes with a lawyer would cost, which is $50. If anybody's interested, I only got a few, but you're welcome. You can write down your credit card or check or whatever. I want to take questions. Yes, sir.
Yeah, how about discrimination problems now, especially with the new sexual laws, homosexuals and application process? We tried to apply, all we wanted to put in formally organized with Christian character. Well, you can't put that in your advertisement because it happens to visit your church organ Christian. So the Philadelphia Choir refused to even accept our ad.
Okay.
What do we do in terms of protecting yourself and not being up for discrimination because you would like to hire somebody who believes in Jesus?